Good afternoon, Vashon and Maury Islands, and all the ships at sea. This is History Worth Hearing, a presentation of the Vashon Heritage Museum, and I am your host, Chris Austin. We have a great show for you today. We'll be talking with David Williams. He is the October presenter for the museum's speaker series. We'll discuss his new book, Home Waters, A Human and Natural History of Puget Sound. It is a fascinating look at the interaction of human culture and geology. We'll also have some trivia for you, but we'll start off with an interview with Toby Holmes. You may have heard recently that he and his wife Amy set out to recreate George McCormick's 1938 walk around Vashon and Maury Islands. As always, the interviews are conducted over Zoom, so I apologize for any sound issues. Okay, Vashon, we have a treat for you today. I have a guest, Toby Holmes, and you may have heard about his adventure with his wife, Amy. Just a couple of weeks ago, they went on a trek around the island to mimic George McCormick's trek back in 1938.
That's right, yeah.
I was amazed. I mean, to try and do that, you know, when you're 19, and this was to commemorate your 50th birthday, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, wow. Well, you got to tell us why. How'd you get the inspiration?
Yeah, earlier in the summer, Amy and I were out walking one morning, and we tried to do a daily walk or a run. And she said, "What do you want to do for your birthday? 50 is a big deal. We should do something kind of exciting." And I had just read the story of George McCormick walking around the island, and I thought, that sounds right up our alley. Let's try it. And originally, the idea was just we were going to go do it. And she said, "Well, maybe we can try to raise some money and develop some interest around this." So that's how the project took legs. But really, the inspiration was turning 50. It's almost exactly 50 miles around the island. And we thought, let's come up with an audacious goal and try to raise $50,000. So that was our home run target. So that's how the whole notion started.
My goodness. So had you grew up on Vashon, right? You were born here, is that correct?
Yeah, born on the beach on Dolphin Point.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, just off Bunker Trail. So for me, actually, this was a real personal thing too. I really wanted to have that experience of walking the beach and celebrating the island. And it was a great way to be connected with the natural environment, as well as, you know, making an adventure, a physical challenge out of it.
Did you have any problem with people going, "Who are these guys walking across in front of my house?"
Or anything? No. Well, when we planned this, we knew that we were going to be up against challenges with tides and with the, you know, just the natural environment, the beaches, fallen trees and things like that. You know, George McCormick, he was one powerful guy physically. And so we thought, well, you know, it's been done a few times. Let's try it. And so we studied the tide charts to try to pick a day where we had the fewest hours above a certain tide level. And we have diurnal tides here where you have a high and then a low high and then a high again and then back down. So we knew above, you know, 6 or 7 feet of tide, substantial amounts of the island just were not passable. And so based on that, we wound up setting off 5:30 in the morning from Liza Bula, walking south. And before to address your original question, you know, we were a little bit worried about whether we would disturb anyone, but we made flags and it's just the two of us, so we're kind of quiet and not making a big deal of it. But, you know, we knew we'd have to cross Camp South, for example, and they're sensitive about people going on the beach there. And we did pass a couple other people walking. They just said hi. We moved on. The only place where we bumped into someone who was really excited about it was this woman kind of near Lost Lake, out on her bulkhead doing some gardening, and she wanted to take video and pictures and hear all about it. Otherwise, everyone was encouraging. While our goal was to walk around the whole island nonstop, we hit the inevitable challenge of high tide. So we made it 20 miles, So from Vizibula down around Tahlequah and then up to Judd Creek. By the time we got to Judd Creek, we were up to our waist in water. And it was like being in an escape room. The water just kept coming up faster and faster. And we weren't worried. It was the middle of the day and it was warm out, but it was really clear that we weren't going to be making any progress for a while. And that was really demoralizing because we had the spiritual energy, the enthusiasm to keep going, but our legs were tired and we were a little scraped up. So we wound up retreating a little bit back to the yacht club. And we sat down there at the picnic table and scratched our head and thought, wow, what do we do? Amy's knee was really giving her the business, and she's had a bad knee for a while. So we knew this was going to be sort of the last big push on it before she'd have to go see a doctor. And we're looking at the tide charts and we're thinking, we're not going to be able to go anywhere for probably 6 or 7 hours. What do we do? And it became clear that, maybe with her knee, we weren't going to make it that much further anyhow. So she said, wait a minute, let's just change what we're doing. Let's go home, get the kayaks, put the kayaks in at Portage and finish our trip around Vashon. So that was we're aiming for a touchdown and I think we scored a field goal. So we went back, got the kayaks on the truck, set in at Portage. That was about 7:30 at night when we set in and paddled up to Dolphin Point and got out on the beach there. And it was about 10:30 at night. Ate some sandwiches that a friend made for us and, had that celebration of turning 50 on Dolphin Point and, seeing my childhood house and the neighborhood where I played around on the beach. And then we got back in the kayaks and finished paddling, got back to Lizabula at 1:30 in the morning.
Oh my gosh.
It turned out to be 20 miles of walking and 16 miles of kayaking. Different vision than what we had planned, but it was... Yeah. Awesome. It was so
20 hours, right?
Yeah.
From 5:30 to 1:30. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That is incredible.
Yeah, as I look back on the trip, I wonder if it's possible to do all of it. Maury Island and Vashon in under 24 hours. I'm not convinced. You'd have to run and you'd have to swim. And even so, I kind of want someone else to try it to see if it's possible. And I know a number of folks have expressed a lot of interest in it and are kind of planning similar trips. So I hope someone else tries it and can share strategies or ideas. Not that I'm going to try it again, but I'd just be curious.
Well, you think about it, George McCormick, it took him like 22 hours, I believe.
Something like that, yeah.
And you walked 3 miles an hour, it would take you 17 hours or so. So
nonstop.
He was nonstop. And so he was up there. Like you said, probably ran and
I think he did. When we're planning the trip, we actually went out on our speedboat at different tide levels to look at different parts of the island to determine where we might have some challenges and try to plan our timing of where we'd be at different tide levels. It was very clear to us that you had to be through inner quartermaster at the low tide because it's so muddy and almost all bulkheads that you could get stuck there. But there's a lot of sections of the island that have fallen trees down. So even if you have a few feet of walkable beach, you wind up climbing through these jungle gyms of trees. And that was a significant part of the first part of our journey from Lizabula to Camp South. Definitely we were climbing through trees and that slows you way down.
Wait, you don't think of that when you think walk around the island, you get to deal with trees.
One of the big lessons or reflections on the trip was, how different is the beach now from when George McCormick did it? And we've had a couple of different people reflect on that. Bianca Perla at the Nature Center contributed some really interesting ideas. Three facts that came to mind is that sea levels are about 6 inches higher now than in the 1930s. Also, due to climate change, the winter storms are stronger. And so it's changed the nature of the beach where now we have more mud and cobblestone. back then it was likely to be more sort of sand and gravel, which is easier to walk on. The other thing I noticed is that there's almost no bull kelp left. We saw a small patch near Dilworth, but even when I was a kid, there'd be huge patches on the north end and even down by Tahlequah. And what bull kelp does is if you have big waves, it acts like a shock absorber. And so the waves don't crash onto the beach, or they just sort of, the sea rises and falls, but it doesn't churn the beach up as much. This couple areas where we did see some kelp, the beach was definitely easier to walk on, which was an interesting observation that makes me, want to learn more about the scientific processes behind that. And then just this week, someone emailed and said, she was a family historian for her family, and her family knew the McCormicks. And she said, boy, I think in the 1930s, most of the woods or the forest around the beaches were fairly well logged. And so there might not have been any or very
that
few
is
logs.
A very good point. Yep.
It just, makes you realize that the natural environment really has changed in a lot of different ways. And I'll say that, Amy and I are in good shape, and every step required concentration. We were using hiking poles, and normally when we're out for a walk, we chat, we sing, we solve all the world's problems. This time we were heads down, every step focusing on not twisting our ankle, not getting wet, trying to avoid sloppy mud. So it was really, that was really interesting. And that's mentally exhausting too.
Yeah,
just factors that, and we had practiced different sections of the beach, but that was a significant challenge that we didn't necessarily expect.
Yeah, well, I think logging commercially just kind of petered out in the early 40s. So yeah, that would have been a much different environment tree-wise. Yeah. Interesting.
And now about 50% of the shoreline is armored with bulkheads and things. And you can tell when you come up to a bulkhead, people build bulkheads out into the water. They don't build them back into the land. And so in almost every case, it does compress the amount of beach that's available. And it does change the nature of the shore, the sand and gravel versus mud and clay. And so, and I grew up on the beach. We had a bulkhead and I remember observing how that changed the beach as well. But that's a factor that has changed since the original walk as well.
So, you said you recently read an article about George McCormick. Did that article include that very famous picture of him starting out at Tahlequah?
Yeah, right. That yeah, with Sheriff Shattuck shooting the gun to start off.
I can't believe that. I just think, how about today you get a King County sheriff to take his firearm to start off your walk? I don't think that would happen.
Well, I think the even more profound is Shattuck met McCormick along the way and gave him alcohol foot rubs. So I'd like to say,
I didn't know that.
I think it would be, get the King County Sheriff to do that would be pretty exciting too. it's interesting to go back to that original article, there is some timeline that he presents or that's reported, and it doesn't quite make sense. When he set out at Tahlequah, and then when they say he was at Docton and then somewhere else, I'm like, it doesn't add up. And I'm certainly not disputing that he did it, but it does show that over time these detailed facts may have been told or retold in certain ways that they don't quite add up. Now I'm friends with George's nephew, who's in his 80s, and he told me recently, he said, George was incredibly strong and strong-willed, so not the type of guy to back down from a challenge. Reportedly, when he was in high school, he'd haul gold out of the mountains with a backpack. And so he's used to just, and he was kind of a small guy, but really strong.
Yeah.
And so, really hard scrabble guy. And I think that that part of the story I find really appealing also, just envisioning him just going for it. And whether he had to swim or run or whatever, he was not going to give up. And I think that says a lot about, the history.
It really does. And he was so influential, the hardware store, and then you got the Vachon Vigilantes with the Black Ball ferry line, you know, giving them axe handles and whatnot to keep them off the dock. I mean, he was quite a character. And he did all for $67, right?
Yeah, and according to Bruce Mercer, there may be some evidence that he was never paid for that. Which, who knows? But I have heard of at least one other person walking around the island at once, and the story, I don't have a copy of it, but I think Amy found it in some archives. Someone who worked at the Nike missile site in, I think it was the early 70s, 1973 or something. Really? It was about the time that they were either removing the nuclear warheads or whatever, but there was some more activity and people here at the Nike site. And he evidently ran it in 17 hours.
Oh my God. And
so that, I wish there was more news or information about that, seeing as that was more recent, about 50 years ago.
Yeah, I think Beachcomber would have that or some kind of news article.
So, but you know, really the thing about the McCormick story that really was the inspirational piece was, at that time, communities on Vashon really didn't have the sense of connection like they do today. And think about how Liza Bula probably felt more connected with Olala because of the ferry service, the mosquito fleet.
Absolutely.
And the trade, and there were 16 different schools and all these different post offices. It was like a bunch of isolated communities. Mm-hmm. And so when McCormick did this walk, it really brought everyone together as with a common experience.
Yeah.
And that really resonated with me. And so, you know, as people have supported us and donated money for this, that's something that I think a lot of people identified with, that this is something that can bring people together. It's a shared experience. You know, we all live on the same island. And I really liked that aspect of what happened from his walk.
Yeah, and if you go back to that famous picture, there's dozens, it looks like, and probably much more off camera, cheering him on. And that kind of is reflected in that lady that was gardening and wanted to take video of you. And, that's just kind of it's a communal experience.
Right, maybe it was Vashon's moon landing.
So if somebody was gonna try this, what advice would you give them?
You know, do it with someone you love. and you know, a lot of people said, oh, you shouldn't do it at once, you should take time and really, you know, experience it. But part of it was definitely the physical challenge and the mental challenge of doing it, which I do like those type of things. I think you just have to be open-minded and, you know, willing to be flexible if your plans change. But I think I'd love to see a couple more people give it a shot and share their stories or experience. You know, there's definitely a likelihood that there's a better way to plan it from a timing perspective, that, you know, where you could have gotten more miles in. But
where to start it. Maybe start at the hardest part when you're the freshest.
Yeah, right.
You know, things like that. But what's the hardest part?
We thought about starting, you know, in the middle of the night, so that, you know, we looked at every different derivation. And Amy has a background in science. She teaches at McMurray, and she'd studied marine biology in college. And so she took out some GIS maps and did like 1,000 different points along the shoreline so she could get a super accurate reading. We printed off a big map. We showed where we'd be at a 2 mile an hour pace, where we'd be at a 2.5 mile an hour pace. We planned food drops along the way, or places where we thought, you know, you could jump in and use someone's bathroom or refill our water. And so, you know, despite that level of planning, and that's really part of the fun too. You know, as soon as you're walking, something else is going to come up and happen.
Something unpredicted.
Yeah.
So, Toby, I understand you raised a lot of money for this, more than $67.
more than a bar bet. Yeah. Well, like I said earlier, when we came up with this idea or this vision, Amy really got the idea that this is an opportunity to raise some money for local charities that we care about. Then the hard part became, you know, how do we come up with a small list of the charities we care about? Because there's so many deserving charities on the island that are doing great work. I'm on the school board. She's a teacher. Our kids are in school. So we felt the school's foundation was one of those that that makes a lot of sense. She's on the board of the land trust. And given the natural history experience, that felt like a really important charity. The Heritage Center, for sure. And thanks to the leadership there for kind of sponsoring it. And so that obviously made a ton of sense. And then also our kids row with Vashon Island Rowing Club. And it's been a really important part of their experience physically and mentally, especially in the last 18 months with COVID. You know, it's gotten them through some challenging times, that community. And then the food bank was another one that we felt passionate about supporting. So yeah, we wound up raising a little over $12,000, and that'll get distributed evenly across those charities. And it's not too late to donate. We created a website where we collected the money and things, but if people felt inspired or motivated, they could donate at the Vashon Heritage Museum and just indicate that it was part of this experience, and then that money will get distributed as well. You know, as much as raising the money, which is great, it's just getting people to participate on the experience and the journey, and you know, feel some buy-in. We had people donate from around the country, family and friends, and so it wasn't just an island experience, and that was also fun to share. It helps people remember how special Vashon is and how unique this community is. Yeah, we appreciate that.
Wow. Well, from the all of the island and the museum, I think I can speak for them. Thank you for your efforts, and thank you for your planning and your thoughts to help the community. I mean, that's just wonderful. And if I might just say real quick, that was VashonHeritageMuseum.org. That's where you could donate to your effort. Well, yeah, thank you perfect. So much for coming on the show. This has been great. I just I can't wait what the 60th birthday brings, but an adventure.
Right. Well, now Amy's like, well, what am I going to do for my 50th? And we'll come up with something. But I will say that you know, a couple of special moments on the experience. One was near Lost Lake. We saw five or six river otters, like four babies and a mama, hop down out of the bushes and down into the water and jumping off rocks. And that was pretty cool. And then when we were kayaking in the middle of the night, there was just enough moonlight and sort of ambient light that we could go without our headlamps. And part of it was glass calm, and the boats, we had phosphorescence coming off the bow of the boat and from our paddles, and we were really tired. And so it was like a dream state, and both Amy and I are strong kayakers. We were just flying, and that part was really incredible.
I bet it was. I mean, it's so dark, you probably don't have a distinct horizon, but you got this floating lights beside you. Wow, what an experience.
Yeah. And we're trying to, like, you know, pick out different house lights to, you know, okay, we'll be there in 15 minutes, and try and stay close to shore because we knew we were tired and didn't want to, you know, get swamped by a boat wake or something. That was a really special part of the experience as well.
Very inspirational.
Chris, really nice chatting with you today. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, Toby. I appreciate you taking the time to do this, and you welcome back anytime.
Thank you.
All right, it is trivia time. Got a couple of three questions for you here. Number one, in 1914, the Vashon Electric Company was established. Where was it located? Number two, in 1920, an area of Vashon named Lucetta Beach was purchased. Who bought it and for what purpose? And number three, today we can easily drive along the water from Ellisport to Portage, but that wasn't always the case. When was a road constructed, and why? All right, Vashon, we have a guest for you today, David Williams, who is a speaker at the October speaker series for the Vashon Heritage Museum, and he's talking about a new book that he has out. And first of all, David, give us a little background about yourself.
Yeah, thank you for asking. Thank you for having me here. I'm looking forward to my talk. I grew up in the Seattle area and lived here for most of my life. For the last 25 years or so, I've been based out of Seattle. And through that time, I have been a freelance writer, a variety of magazine articles, but primarily writing books focused on what I think of as that intersection between people and the natural world. How do we influence landscape, and how does landscape influence us? And I've done this through books such as Too High and Too Steep, Reshaping Seattle's Topography, that looks at the big engineering events in the Seattle area in the late 1800s, early 1900s, the Denny Regrade, the building of the Ship Canal, the filling in of the tide flats. I did it through a book called Stories in Stone, Travels Through Urban Geology, that looks at how do we use stone as a building material. And although that book is not focused on the Seattle region, it is still, many of the rocks that I talk about from different parts of the country were used in the Seattle area. So those stories can be told here as well. Also did a book that's a collection of essays, or excuse me, a collection of walks, 17 walks around the Seattle area that weave together human and natural history. My goal as a writer ultimately is, I hope to help people connect to the place they live, to slow down, to ask questions, to be more observant, to really develop, more strongly develop a relationship to the place and to home that's around them. So that's what I've been doing. And then my newest book is Home Waters, A Human and Natural History of Puget Sound.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I've always been a kind of an armchair historian. And for 5 years, I worked at the San Bernardino Natural History Museum, where I met a lot of geologists and paleontologists. And I would go out in the field with them, and we would look at a valley, and they would tell me the history, the geologic history of it. And to me, it's just like you said, I felt more connected to the land to know what had happened here. And, you know, maybe what its future was and that sort of thing. So I think this is a perfect talk for a heritage museum, is a history of the geology of the area.
Yeah, I mean, I really see history in two levels. I see history of the geologic level, which is what really, sort of my first passion is that geologic story of place. But I'm also really interested in human history. And in particular, sort of going back to my original thought about connection of place, is what is that intersection between geologic time and human time? And how does that influence the story of a place? We can't tell the story of the Sound and its people without thinking about that geologic aspect. The Ice Age, 20,000 years ago, 18,000 years ago, ice comes in, moves down south of Olympia, then retreats or melts back to the north. As that ice moves in and carves the land and deposits sediment, that is critical for the story that develops over the thousands of years that people have lived here. I mean, we'd be a very different place without that geologic story, and a very active geologic story. We all know about it from earthquakes, you know, the most recent one, obviously, in 2001, the Nisqually quake, but we're bound to get more.
So when you think about human terraforming, and it was, for most of human history, that's been very slight, not a huge impact. But now, today, these huge projects, I mean, who's winning? are we conquering the environment, or are they going to conquer us?
Yeah, no, that's a funny question. I mean, a good one. I don't mean funny enough, but it's, I mean, I always buy the idea of nature bats last. I mean, and there's a lot of hubris that we do, and we think we can control nature. And I, you know, sadly, I mean, where we're seeing it is, look at climate change. You know, we have affected the environment very strongly and changed the climate around us. And that climate, then, what we're concerned about is how we've altered it to the point where climactic conditions, weather conditions have that potential to do significant damage. You know, we were here during the heat dome. That was not really pleasant. And, you know, the increase of hurricane strength in the Gulf Coast, or, you know, how is it going to affect our snowmelt? You know, we have good evidence that that's going to change over time. So that is it's a constant, not sure conflict's the right word, but it's a constant interaction between what we do and how the land and water and an atmosphere react.
You know, we had another guest on the show earlier, a man named Toby Holmes, who recreated a very famous walk where he walked around the shoreline of Vashon Island. And the famous walk was a guy named George McCormick, who in 1938 walked around the entire coastline, 50 miles in under 24 hours. And what we talked about was, even during that 1938 to today, how much the environment changed. Because when he did his walk in 1938, the timber industry was coming to a close. The beaches had no trees on them. But today, he said this was like a jungle gym, walking through all of these trees. And the other thing was all the bulkheads that have been put up. That has drastically changed how the beach is walkable.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's definitely a point that I make in the book, this idea of armoring and how we have altered the shoreline. And yeah, to me, one of the themes in the book is looking at how people, again, as people have used the resources here. And we see it from the very earliest. We certainly see it. I mean, Native people were altering the landscape. I mean, we know of evidence of burning. We know of evidence of altering shorelines through middens, perhaps also through clam gardens, where they would basically build a low wall and allow sediment to fill in and create a spot. And what they were doing, though, what's different is, one, the scale was smaller, but two, it was often based on, you know, long-term observation and stewardship of the land. So that was a big change. But even then, once European settlers arrived, we see those changes begin. The Hudson's Bay Company, which is the first group of settlers, Europeans, to establish a base here and down at Fort Nisqually, and they start immediately taking the beaver. If you take the beaver, you're going to affect the population of salmon. So that's, you know, it's both a geological and an ecological change. And then again, when we see logging go in, logging is going to have a geological and ecological change. As sediment gets washed into the water, you have a change of dynamic of shoreline, change of dynamic of bluffs, which alters the salmon, which alters the forage fish, which has an effect on orca. I mean, everything's connected here. Here's again, Puget Sound is no different, except the stories are right around us, and to me, very, very visceral stories.
Well, I can imagine early European settlers coming in, and they see the beaver and they see the woods, and it's just like unlimited bounty to them in their eyes. They have no idea that the consequences down the road. So when did science really get a sense of, we have to change something? We can't go on this way forever.
Yeah, I mean, that to me is a great question, and it's really a theme in the book for me, of thinking about that idea. I keep coming back to, how do people connect to the land? And we see that the first settlers who come in here, again, the Hudson's Bay Company, but then soon after, as citizens of what become the United States citizens, come into this area, they start immediately basically exploiting the land. And, you know, I don't think we can condemn them, because, as you say, we could not imagine the plenty, the bounty here was just unimaginable. And from that, they couldn't imagine that they would ever have any effect on it. But they did. And those early generations really did change this place. But really in the last handful of decades, we've seen a really fundamental change in both science and government, as well as just the sort of feel that people have. And I sort of phrase that as a move from a view of exploitation to a view of stewardship and sustainability. I would argue that that is a very dominant feeling in the Sound, that the people who live here really do recognize the incredible beauty, diversity, resiliency of this place, and want to do something to make it better. And we see that in science. We see that as scientists develop a much better understanding of the ecology of this place. I was just talking the other day to a couple of biologists who work with rockfish, this incredible group of 20 plus species, all in a single genus that inhabit all levels of the Sound. And they're doing research that just in the last couple of years has created a better understanding, which is leading to better management. And this is particularly important because rockfish, two of the species of these 20 plus species, are on the threatened and endangered list of endangered species. And so there is a management plan and working to how can we improve the populations of these species? And the reason they got to this level is because of exploitation, because of a lack of understanding of their biology led to a decimation of the population. Now, as we understand better, we're working towards better management. We have a long ways to go, but it's a path we are on instead of a path, we have a path forward instead of a path backward, I would argue. And they're not alone. Rockfish are not alone. Many species were heading on that forward path.
So how long an era does your book cover? Is it just human habitation? Does it go back before humans were here? What's the time period?
Yeah, basically since the last ice age. I talk about how this place formed, again, because I think it's so important to understand the geology and its effect on the landscape. But then I look at when did people move into this area? What are the earliest records we have of people? And that goes back about 13,000 years, 12,500 years to a site in Redmond, which was a spot where people were making stone tools, stone implements. And then I come forward in time with looking at a couple of different aspects of how people live in this area. How did they react to the resources? How did they react to each other? And also looking at the Sound as a maritime highway. How did people move through this very challenging topography? Water is the dominant way, but what is that story and how did they adapt to it and adapt their vessels to it? And then also looking at how do people defend themselves? This is a valuable place for many people, and how do you protect yourself? And so looking at things such as the forts at the north end, Fort Worden, Casey, and Flagler, but then also going back and looking at Indigenous people and trying to understand those, always with this goal of understanding what is the relationship between the inhabitants and place. And then I also look at several animal species. I've mentioned rockfish, but I look at herring. I look at Olympia oyster and geoduck. I look at salmon and orca, always, again, weaving together their relationship, their adaptations to place to better understand our relationship to them and our relationship to management of them.
Well, from my understanding of conventional wisdom, that this area was populated as humans came over the Bering Strait from Asia. But I've also recently been reading about they may have come in watercraft that kind of hugged the coast and hopscotched along there, feeding on marine mammals and fish and stuff like that. Is there a lot of merit to that argument? Is that something we're finding out?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's really exciting that we're starting to see what you're saying. People refer to this as the kelp highway. So instead of coming overland in the sort of ice-free corridor through Canada, they actually would travel along the shoreline, exactly as you said, and taking advantage of these incredible kelp forests where they would find abundant food. I mean, all sorts of different animals there, from very small to these massive mammals that were living in there, tons of fish. So a great place to find food and also a great place where you could tie up. As that bull kelp grows up to the surface or the giant kelp, you could tie up to it. And that kelp then also acted to attenuate the waves. So you travel along the coast along that kelp highway and your off ramp, one of the best off ramps, is down into Puget Sound. And we're starting to see that story is being better understood by the archaeologists. And in fact, one ethnobotanist I talked to makes the claim, and I think it's a valid one, that our longest relationship with any plant in the region is kelp, going back, 15,000 years. And I just think that's an incredible connection that is permeated through Indigenous people and now into you know, into modern times, I think is pretty remarkable.
Well, I think that's fascinating to think that our most valuable plant, as it were, grows in the ocean. And not.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really interesting. You also mentioned that you wanted to have a signal of hope in the book. What could you tell an individual like myself? What can I do to make things better for the future?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And let me back up my hope idea with a couple of observations. One, as I said, that idea that we've moved from exploitation to stewardship. And because of that, arguably, Puget Sound is arguably in better shape than it's been in many decades. We're seeing cleanup, we're seeing work to make it better, we're seeing work to improve habitat. Again, we're not where we want to be, but we're headed in that direction. I think, again, as we've talked with the scientists developing better understanding, we have the tools for better management. We also realize and see in places that these animals, which have adapted, are incredibly resilient. I mean, think of the Elwha Dam. Elwha dams are taken down, and within just a incredibly rapid amount of time, salmon move back up into that riverway. And as one biologist said, one reason they're able to do that is they've been doing that for thousands of years. They've faced other barriers, and that there's a resiliency. I like to think of it sort of like the DNA of the sound really runs in their bodies, and we have that potential is incredible. In terms of what we can do, I was inspired the other day by a comment I heard by a scientist at the University of Washington. And she said, you know, I'm really tired of this phrase that people, I've been bothered for a long time with this phrase that nothing I do makes a difference. Because if you compare an individual with what is going on in the world around us, corporations, government, we are just small. But she said, I've decided to turn that phrase around and say, everything I do makes a difference. And I think that's a really great way to think of the world, is that whatever I'm doing, think about it from that picture of the sound. What can I do to promote better health in the sound? Do I drive less? Do I make sure I vote for candidates who believe in climate change? Do I contribute to organizations? Do I get involved? Do I get to know this place better? To me, one of the highlights of my book was spending a day at Discovery Park in Seattle and watching the tide go in and the tide go out, to see the dynamic of this place, the incredible beauty of it. And so by getting to know the area better, I have developed a better, deeper connection, deeper relationship. Therefore, I recognize the importance of my actions to making this a better place.
So kind of incremental habits that we all could change, you know, not gonna go live in a yurt, but maybe I'll do one or two things and then later one or two more things. And those can all add up to helping the future.
Yeah, and I think if we do them, then we are going to have the potential to be more supportive of change that's on a government basis, that's on industry basis, that is that larger scale change that is also critical to the story. And so, yeah.
So where can we get this book? It just sounds fascinating.
Home Waters is available at all good bookstores. I think the Vashon Island, their bookstore has it. Independent bookstores have it. My website, Geology Writer, if you want a signed copy, that's probably the best way. You can buy it directly through me. So all good bookstores have it. If they don't, they should.
They should. I agree. So your talk is October 14th. Let me just reiterate for the audience. It's at 7 p.m. and you can sign up at VashonHeritageMuseum.org. It's free. Sounds like it's going to be a wonderful talk, and I really appreciate you taking the time to do this for the museum.
My pleasure and honor, Chris. It's great. Glad we had a chance to have this conversation.
All right, time for some trivia answers. Question number one. In 1914, the Vashon Electric Company was established. Where was it located? And the answer is Ellisport. Electricity first came to the island in 1914 when the Vashon Electric Company built a steam generating plant at Ellisport. When Washington's governor Ernest Lister pressed a button to start the generators and light Ellisport. For the first few years, electricity was only available until midnight. but by 1916, 24-hour electric service was instituted. Question number two. In 1920, an area of Vashon named Luesta Beach was purchased. Who bought it, and for what purpose? And the answer is the Campfire Girls of America purchased it. They were founded in 1912, and the purchase was in 1920, and the reason for it was they began Camp South, the first permanent resident camp for girls in the state of Washington. And question number three. Today, we can easily drive along the water from Ellisport to Portage, but that wasn't always the case. When was a road constructed, and why? The answer is, the road from Ellisport to Portage along Tramp Harbor was completed in November 1916. When the new dock for the Portage-Des Moines Ferry was constructed, this new ferry route was the island's first automobile ferry, and the new dock was built near where the current Tramp Harbor fishing pier is located. Well, that's our show. If you made it this far, I appreciate you listening. I'd also like to thank my guests, Toby Holmes and David Williams. I hope you can catch David's talk on October 14th at 7 p.m. And it's free. Just go to the VashonHeritageMuseum.org to sign up. I'd also like to thank everyone at the museum that made this possible. So thank you, Vashon and Maury Islands. Have a great weekend. And be sure to catch the Mostly True radio show at 4 p.m.